This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Sleepy Joe Biden.
One advisor to major Democratic Party donors said they were texting from a meeting of donors in Atlanta on Thursday night, some writing, WTF. Our only hope is that he bows out, we have a broken convention, or dies, the donor advisor says. Otherwise, we are fucking dead.
Yeah, either he's dead or we're dead. Those are the choices.
I mean, I think America's probably done. We had a patchy run.
We've moved past the need for America.
Fuck me. It is genuinely difficult to determine whether to laugh or cry. Probably both, really. That's probably the correct response. But I don't know have you seen many clips of the debate? It's so bleak.
It's very bleak. I think the only clip I've seen like 5-second clips, but there's the one where Biden says something like, "Well, the only convicted criminal on this stage is the one next to me," and Trump just sort of like nods, like, "Well, touche." He's just like, "Yep, touche. That's me." And then Biden just like staring into space and completely dissociating.
I mean, the clip that's getting the biggest run is this one.
Eligible for what I've been able to do with. Dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare, and I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more Border Patrol and more asylum officers.
President Trump?
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either. Look.
Which is totally true.
Oh, yeah, I saw
true.
That little clip. Yeah.
I mean, and it's like there were moments watching it where you're like, oh, we're going to see this man die. These are
his
final
words. He's
going to
die right now. Yeah.
He's about to expire.
Finally, hey.
The other deeply depressing bit is when Trump just calls Biden a Palestinian.
He doesn't want to do it. He's become like a Palestinian. But they don't like him because he's a very bad Palestinian. He's a weak one.
As if it's a fucking insult. And, you know, I've seen lots of people with Palestinian heritage or Palestinians themselves saying, this is insane that a presidential nominee just called his opponent a Palestinian as if that's a fucking diss.
Yeah.
And suggesting that he's sort of weak and like, yes, weak. He's too
weak.
But he's
not a good Palestinian or something.
He's a bad Palestinian. He's a weak Palestinian. He's obviously completely invested in the Palestinian cause, even though his administration is overseeing a genocide of the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
But he's a weak one and he can't stop the...
Well, I guess this is Trump trying to get both. Trying to be like, if you hate Palestine, he's a Palestinian. If you care about Palestine, he is not a Palestinian.
Another genius political move here from Mr. Trump.
Mm.
And so now there is very serious, and perhaps this has even progressed further. Potentially, Joe Biden is not even the nominee by the time people hear this.
But really? Like, is that actually possible?
Well, I would normally say no, that's ridiculous. But I mean, the widespread consensus of people, including the most Democratic-pilled, liberal-brained idiots from CNN and MSNBC, people from the Pod Save America world. Everyone watch this debate and said, this is unacceptable. This is elder abuse. This man cannot run to be president. And I included that group, the New York Times editorial board, okay, that just published a piece called To Serve His Country, President Biden Should Leave the Race. The president appeared on Thursday night as the shadow of a great public servant. He struggled to explain what he would accomplish in a second term. He struggled to respond to Mr. Trump's provocations. He struggled to hold Mr. Trump to account for his lies, his failures, and his chilling plans. More than once, he struggled to make it to the end of a sentence.
Can I just also, God, Americans are so funny. Like, what a weird editorial policy that they keep calling him Mr. Trump. Can you imagine an Australian outlet being like, Mr. Albert, like they just use the last name. Just say Albert.
That's a level of respect and civility that we've come to expect from the New York Times. Mm. I mean, it is also so fucking galling that, as someone put it on Twitter, I think it's incredible that Democrats have had a harder time defending Joe Biden's debate performance than his complicity in genocide. And I mean, missing from all of this is the fact that, you know, this fucking guy.
Yeah, this is the last straw for you. I can excuse genocide, but I draw the line at a bad debate performance. But yes. I also, maybe like, I guess in America, and I don't pay much attention to American politics really, I'm like that meme that's like American problem, don't want to know. That's that's me. But the debate is very big there in a way that like we have leaders debates or whatever, but it's not like a cultural thing in a way that I understand it is in US politics. Like your performance at this debate really matters.
Well, it's just in terms, yes. I mean, just in terms of the clips that come out of it, I suppose, and the general impression that people have.
Mm.
I mean, you know, you could say that Hillary Clinton probably won all her debates and it didn't make any difference, but Biden agreed to this debate. He challenged Trump, and this is the earliest debate they've ever had. This is all on him, and he did it. He went in there with the task of proving his mental acuity. He failed that test. He failed it real bad because he could barely construct a fucking sentence. And the same people who spent years and years on Barack Obama's dick because he could deliver a good speech, because he could reject confidence and could talk good. We were told how important and inspiring and wonderful hope and change that was, are now backing in fucking Grandpa Joe, who cannot say words.
Yes, we can commit war crimes. That's what we want to hear.
I got to say, under the editorial piece from the NYT, like there are like three other, you know, they've got little like clips that show other opinion pieces that are on there. The three other opinion pieces underneath this one. Joe Biden is a good man and a good president. He must bow out of the race. I'm hearing high anxiety from Democrats over Biden's debate performance. The best president of my adult life needs to withdraw. It's very depressing. I do not want Donald Trump to be president. He probably will be at this point, and we probably have to accept that. It's a fucking disgrace. It's an absolute shambles. But fuck all these people. Fuck all these people that sabotaged Bernie Sanders, that didn't see 4 years ago when Joe Biden was bleeding out of his eye during a debate. And there were people in 2020 writing the same pieces, sort of saying this guy is not all there, and
anything
the way he
Bernie,
presents
though.
Himself is not ideal. Thank you very much.
Mm.
And fuck all the progressive people in Australia too, who are celebrating centrist Joe is the guy we need now, who also are turning a blind eye to his complicity in genocide. The idea that you would have any sympathy for people who are like, gosh, how could we possibly see this coming? You do not deserve it, my friends. This is entirely your bed, and you have fucking made it. And I think I've seen a lot of arguments, people saying, well, it's either Biden or Trump, though that's your choice. And people saying, no, if you stick with Biden, you are going to get Trump. This guy cannot win this election because he can barely fucking speak in public.
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's a fucked electoral system as well, though. Like, I don't know what I would do if I was in America. I guess, I probably couldn't vote for Biden. I probably would vote for a third party. Are the Greens okay? What are they like over there? Are they one of the weird ones? Are they okay?
I need to research more about this. Jill Stein looks like she's going to be the Greens nominee as well. The Greens don't set up their presidential nominee till August, which I think seems a bit bizarre, but I'm sure there's a whole bunch of process stuff that I didn't know about it. In the past, there was a bunch of talk about Jill Stein's approach to vaccines being skeptical. My understanding is that that's actually a bit of bullshit and a bit of smearing, and that actually if you dig into it, it's not true. And everything I hear from Jill Stein is that she's a pretty awesome progressive candidate, or is at least someone providing some kind of alternative to the vision. I don't know why Cornel West ran in the Greens and then dropped out. I mean, you know, it's truly cooked in terms of like there is no alternative for an outside challenger to get involved with. But my understanding is that the Green Party will be on enough ballots in theory to win 270 electoral votes. So in theory, the Greens candidate could become the president. And I mean, if you needed any more evidence of the bankrupt nature of the two-party system in America, and if there's any chance, any time to break with that bullshit system, it's surely now in the wake of this insane display.
True.
And so, look, Jill Stein officially won the nomination. You know, how many Americans listen to this? I don't know, but vote Jill Stein. Because she can say words good, and she's not xenophobic, racist idiot. Yeah. Which really puts her at the head of the pack in my book.
You're not going to get much better than that in America.
Or if they bring back Hillary Clinton, I guess, vote for her. Jesus fucking Christ.
Jesus, Tom.
They are much, much more interested in fighting Labor in the inner cities than they are for fighting for more homes for young people and the homeless.
We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
This is a serious danger to Australia.
G'day.
And how you going?
And how you going? It's Serious Danger, a podcast about green politics in Australia, not an official Greens Party podcast, made possible with the help of the Green Institute, and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin.
I found this on the web for Stranger Politics. Check it out.
Thanks, Siri.
Jesus Christ.
Look, Siri wants to help because we've got so much to cover this week that I'm going to be trying to speak at double speed because there is a fuckload on. We're going to cover it the best we can. We've got Assange, we've got Palestine, we've got pill testing, we've got vaping, etc. We also have some new patrons before we do that. Martin, Jim, DJM, maybe. Lupin. Is that a French? Should it be Lupin?
Lupin.
L-U-P, Lupin. Very generous. Thank you, Lupin or Lupin. And Rhiannon, we love you, patrons. Tom did a special little patron ep that came out this week with the leftist streamer Helena at No Justice MTG on the upcoming British election. They talk about parallels with the Australian Greens. The Greens Party of England and Wales have one seat. They're going
please,
for
okay,
four.
Please stop. Please
They're
stop.
Two no, against... No,
for
okay,
for multiple sorry. Reasons, please stop. I since realized this. I didn't really appreciate the time recording this chat with Helena, which is fantastic. People should definitely listen to it. But the parallels with the Australian Greens in this election are pretty wild. They currently have one seat. They won their first seat in the lower house in 2010. They're aiming to increase their representation to four seats. Two of those seats, their major challenges are from the Labor Party, and the two other seats, the challenges are from the Tories. How about
interesting?
Fuck on that?
Sounds familiar.
Since then, Hugh Grant has endorsed the Greens candidate, Carla Denyer. Wow. And I thought you'd like this very briefly, a very insane story out of the British Labour Party. There's this huge betting scandal that's consuming the Tories, like Tory MPs and people associated with the party betting on the outcome of the election and the election date. Very funny, ridiculous. And then a Labour MP recently just had to step down and resign as a candidate when it was exposed that he placed a bet on himself the election, losing the upcoming election.
Oh, against himself. I was going to say, is he voting against or for himself? That's great. But isn't that like, because if you bet, then it'll raise the odds for if you win, and so maybe then people will vote anyway.
He said he was going to donate the proceeds to charity, but I don't believe it for a moment.
Whatever.
But it was a fantastic conversation. Helena is across the detail of almost every policy issue, it seems. A really interesting conversation about the British election, which is happening on July the 4th. Check it out. patreon.com/seriousdangerAU. For just $3 a month, you get all this bonus content. Check it out.
Check it out. Check it out. What's it all
about? All right, let's stop being depressed and have some good news for a change. Good news, everyone.
What? It couldn't be.
Professor Farnsworth voice. Julian Assange's 14 years of persecution are finally over. He is free, free at last, and he is home in Australia.
Insane. Can't believe it. This is wild. Hey, I didn't think this would happen. Did you think this would happen?
I did not think this would happen, no.
No.
And it was all very secretive and very quick. I mean, as recently as June 12th, the Assange campaign was at least focused on the fact of his next trial date, which is scheduled for July 10th, which is this appeal that he was allowed to do in the UK. That's sort of where all the energy was going towards. That's what we're ready for. Then basically in secret, a deal was reached. Julian was secretly ushered out of Belmarsh prison in the UK. He'd been languishing there for the past 5 years. It was 2 a.m. He was put on a plane, flew to the Northern Mariana Islands, which is a US territory in the Pacific, where he pled guilty to a felony charge of conspiracy to obtain and disclose national defense information. Now, it wasn't like a full plea. It was a little bit qualified.
Okay.
Julian told the court, working as a journalist, I encouraged my source to provide information that was said to be classified in order to publish that information. I believe the First Amendment protected that activity. I believe the First Amendment and the Espionage Act are in contradiction.
Okay.
Now, apparently I heard some reports that after Julian said that, his lawyer got up and said, okay, just to be really clear, he's definitely fully guilty.
Right. Okay.
I guess that's just so Julian Assange. You can't
the deal,
shut him up.
But he just, yeah.
But just to be clear, definitely guilty. Please let us leave if possible.
Yeah.
Under the plea deal that had been struck, Assange received credit for the time spent incarcerated in the UK. We'll talk about that in a moment. But meaning that he was free to return home to Australia. He flew home. And, of course, you know, this is the big story of the week. Everyone saw the footage and the celebrations and him being welcomed home and him being returned to his family and then being very, very happy.
I thought he was with Pamela Anderson. What happened there?
Pamela Anderson was an ally who visited him regularly, and we all realised that, our probably sexist perception of who Pamela Anderson was is completely mistaken, and she's a cool lady with cool politics.
They weren't dating.
They were just friends, I believe, yes.
Oh, completely got that one wrong.
Stella Assange, his wife, I believe was his lawyer at some point, was one of his lawyers, and I believe that's how they met.
Confusing. Okay, cool. Gotcha. All right. Sorry, Pamela.
Very important detail. This has not got enough coverage, particularly from critics of Assange, who are constantly wringing their hands about what he did in 2010 and through his work in WikiLeaks, put lives at risk. While Washington has often called Assange's actions reckless and claimed they put its agents at risk, the judge noted that the United States could not identify any personal victim from them. There's another significant fact. The government has indicated there is no personal victim here. That tells me the dissemination of the information did not result in any known physical injury, the judge said.
Okay.
Okay? So...
okay.
Fuck you, Michael Rowland.
So how many years for that?
Yeah, 14 years for exposing war crimes, not hurting anybody. Seems fair to me.
Good.
The Greens said Julian Assange should never have been charged with espionage in the first place or had to make this deal. The party's justice spokesperson, David Shoebridge, said Julian Assange has spent years in jail for the crime of showing the world the horrors of the US war in Iraq and the complicity of governments like Australia, and that is why he's been punished. Greens Senator Peter Whish-Wilson said Assange was targeted for telling an awful, inconvenient truth about war crimes.
An inconvenient truth.
Whoa. He's home. People who are decent and know things about the world and who care about justice and freedom and hate US war crimes are celebrating this fact.
Mm-hmm.
Other fuckheads are saying he's not a journalist, he's not a hero, they're stupid. What did you make of it all, Emerald?
Oh, well, have we spoken, when have we spoken about Assange before? Like, it's so great that he's home and he shouldn't have been imprisoned all that time. And yes, what he did was good and war crimes are bad and the US are bad. Free Assange people tend to be some of the most punishing, annoying people. I don't know what it's a real, like, boomers issue. It's a real, like, people in Byron really into Assange. And part of me is like, yay, they're not going to be as annoying anymore.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if I'm going to be cancelled for that. But no, it's one of those funny things that for some reason it's one of those issues that, like, it's a bit of a sign, you can just tell the kind of person who's really into Assange. But, hey, it's great. He's home. He's free. That's good.
Why do we think that this happened? Why would the US actually offer this plea deal now?
What do you think was coming? I have no idea. I really don't. Why do you think?
Well, I mean, theories that were kicking around is that people thought that the US might actually be in legal trouble here and that, you know, Assange was going to argue the First Amendment protections in this appeal that was coming up, which seems pretty reasonable, right? Like, again, Julian Assange is not a US citizen, okay?
Yeah.
So the idea that he's being persecuted for this crime by the US government, and people talked about the importance of this case is the US's ability to just prosecute anybody in any territory ever and just, you know, wield their imperial law and persecute you for doing anything anywhere, even if you're not a citizen or committed the crimes while you're in America, without applying the same First Amendment protections, right? If you're going to prosecute people for law, those people should also be covered in theory by the protections that
you're going to do your American thing, apply your little American Bill of Rights that you love so much.
Yes. So they thought that was potentially actually going to be in legal trouble. So they thought they'd cut that off. There has been political pressure from various players for quite a long time. I didn't know this. According to Yanis Varoufakis, I was listening to him being interviewed this week, this is the third plea deal that Assange was offered, okay?
Oh.
Apparently he was offered a plea deal during the Trump administration, but part of the deal was that he would have to reveal some of his sources that involved in the leaks surrounding the Hillary Clinton emails, I believe. Because there was the suggestion that he collaborated with Russia and all that kind of nonsense, and he refused to do that. Julian Assange is so committed to not revealing sources, he won't reveal sources even if those sources agree to, you know, being revealed, if they give that okay.
I guess because of the precedent.
Yes, like, totally. Yeah. And the second plea deal he was offered would have required him to travel to continental US, right? And he did not want to do that because he simply did not trust the US, and you should never trust the US, to not just, take him to custody or whack him in a supermax prison and never let him out.
Mm. Yeah,
so that's pretty good. I mean, that first plea deal is a long time ago, so he's continued to stay incarcerated on the basis of principle, which I think is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
Do you view this as a win for press freedom? I mean, the fact that he still had to plead guilty, again, you would totally understand why he would take this particular deal and why the fuck he needed to get out, and his mental and physical health had deteriorated to such a point that he was effectively being tortured in Belmarsh. Mm. I mean, again, remember he was in like isolation, right? Like a non-violent crime that he's being charged with here, but he's been put in like isolation for 23 hours a day or whatever. Like basically was tortured for a very long time in that particular incarceration system. He still had to plead guilty to it. And, you know, the security state, the James Clapper guy from the US security state is sort of saying, well, he served his time, you know, which sort of gives the game away. People saying, well, the punishment is the process here. The process, yes. Rather, is the punishment, yeah. Excuse me. That is, yeah. You can't say that Julian Assange hasn't been punished for his alleged crimes, the crime of doing journalism, because he has been locked up for so long and been put through, yes, this fucking process.
Yeah, yeah, he's been through torture and has, you know, is suffering, as I understand it, long-term mental health impacts as a result of that. And that obviously is designed to be, and no doubt has been, a chilling effect on this type of journalism, because people know something like that could happen to me. So whether it makes people weighing up the risks and benefits, or the public interest benefit of doing this type of thing, we'll go, well, I might get out eventually one day after 14 years. Maybe that'll make things a little bit better, but they're still going to be like, well, I could face that type of treatment. So, you know.
Finally, I guess, you know, who do you think gets the credit for bringing him home? The Albanese government is certainly taking – oh, yes. Okay, right. Don't jump ahead, kids.
Oh, I no, just thought pretty. You said who gets the credit. I assumed the answer was Greens.
Of course.
Whatever we're talking about.
Whatever. Who gets the blame? Labor. Who gets the credit?
Labor.
Greens.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary. The Albanese government is taking this victory lap, taking all the credit of all the good stuff. And Julian Assange apparently on the phone told Anthony Albanese that he saved his life. Now, of course, any political prisoner, when they're released, of course, is going to be very grateful and extend gratitude to the person in power from your home country that played a role in getting him out. I don't want to say that obviously the Albanese government played no role. There has been some diplomatic efforts. But I would say the Labor record on Assange is fucking patchy at best. Kevin Rudd was actually all right back in 2010. He was pretty decent and was sort of recognising the fact that Julian Assange was doing the job of a journalist. Julie Gillard was absolutely atrocious. She's basically implied that what he did was illegal. He said it was gross irresponsibility. Far from offering to advocate on his behalf, her government said it was providing every assistance to US authorities and asked Australian officials to investigate whether he'd broken any of the country's laws as well.
Good.
Gillard maintained there's not anything we can or indeed should do in reference to helping him.
Wow.
I will not be lectured about sexism from this man.
Yeah, it's because he's a man. I mean, I heard a clip, or I saw a clip, maybe it was from Stella Assange's press conference, specifically shouting out Scott Ludlam and saying, you know, when this first happened and we were appealing for support, it was Scott Ludlam from the Greens who was standing up in the Senate and who was, you know, who was advocating for us. He basically was like it was him and the Greens before anyone else, so don't you fucking pretend that you've been here the whole time, sounded like the tenor of that press conference.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's even now, right, Albanese and Penny Wong in all the media interviews, the focus is on the process. Their argument is that this has gone on too long and that nothing can be gained by persecution. So, again, nothing to say about what Julian Assange did, about the war crimes that he exposed and what that should say or make us think about our relationship to the US who committed those war crimes. No real suggestion that this is that none of them will be drawn on the question of whether or not he's a journalist. Both Penny Wong and Albanese constantly wheeling out the same line. Oh, there are a range of views here. There are a range of views, but the process has gone too long.
Yeah,
again,
what's
this
your
focus
view?
On process. Exactly. What is your view? What do you give a shit about press freedom or people speaking up? What do you think this will have, you know, do you think it's have a chilling effect on other journalists and whistleblowers who want to come forward and expose this? I mean, come on. If you want to read more about this, I recommend Rex Patrick's piece in Michael West Media, Should Australian Politicians Claim Credit for the Release of Julian Assange? I mean, he gives the credit overwhelmingly to the Greens, independents, people like Andrew Wilkie has been a hero on this stuff.
Yeah.
And ordinary people, as annoying as they may be, the Free Assange crowd,
yes,
have for years and years and years
being annoying works, maybe, clearly.
I don't know how you can be politically effective without being annoying. I think
yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you're right. I have to admit that.
And this is an extraordinary, you know, people powered campaign, and lots of people thinking and standing up for the right thing, being demonized constantly, being abandoned by a often spineless media class who will happily throw one of their own under the bus, you know, media organizations that published the stories that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks exposed, took all the credit, won all the prizes for that, still, you know, threw him under the bus when it came to his persecution by the US. Fuck you, Latika Burke, who wrote a horrific piece about how, you know, the Albanese government shouldn't tie themselves up with Assange because he could put out more anti-Western rhetoric. By that I mean, I assume she means exposing actual war crimes that the West has done, for fuck's sake.
That's what anti-West, okay.
These people.
Insane.
And also we should take any victory or credit the Albanese government has when it says it's, you know, released Julian Assange with a massive grain of salt, and look at the way they're treating other whistleblowers like David McBride and Richard Boyle too. I mean, they're in government now. People in this country are being persecuted for speaking up and exposing the truth, and the Albanese government doesn't want to know about it. Even their release of Berta Cleary, their decision to stop pursuing him, is mainly due to preserve our relationship with Timor-Leste and make sure we keep getting their oil and gas. So,
yeah. What do you think about the, I mean, just very quickly, all the people tweeting, oh, you're all happy that Assange is being released. Guess what's going to happen when you find out that he's not a raging lefty like you? Everyone's going to be so upset.
I don't care. What are you talking about? I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, they're going to pursue a pardon too, I should mention. So he's currently barred from entering the US as a convicted felon. They're going to lobby for a presidential pardon. Maybe would get one from President Trump. Probably not, I guess. But as said, he's going to go back to keep on doing the work that WikiLeaks does. And the work that WikiLeaks does, I sincerely believe, cannot be categorized as necessarily left or right. Like, it is actually a radical transparency, adversarial journalistic approach to the truth that states and governments lie. They withhold information from the public. We have a right to know this information, and we should see it, you know, warts and all, with some qualifications, within reason. And WikiLeaks does take care in applying those standards to their journalism. I think good journalism is good, whether it exposes people who purport to be on the left or the right.
And whether he's a good journalist or not, I don't think he should have been locked up and tortured for 14 years. So,
do you want a list of the journalists we think should be locked up and tortured?
That's next.
Mr. Truitt, your question to President Reagan.
Mr. President, I want to raise an issue that I think has been lurking out there for 2 or 3 weeks and cast it specifically in national security terms. You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
All right, quickly, I know because there's so much else to cover up, but I do want to touch on another good story, another victory for the Greens this week, pill testing will be permanent in Victoria. Hell yeah, dude. Following an 18-month trial to decide how best to offer the free drug checks to users. From this summer, mobile pill testing teams will visit 10 festivals and events to run pill testing. By mid-2025, the state will also set up a fixed site in the inner city where users will be able to have their drugs checked. They're going to be able to test powders, pills and liquids, but cannabis and mushrooms won't be able to be tested. It's going to cost about $4 million. Premier Jacinta Allen said it was not a green light to use illicit drugs, but it addressed drug use in the community. It's a health response to a problem. Wow. Oh,
sounds familiar. Someone should have suggested this earlier.
Here's a little taste of what Jacinta Allen had to say in the video she put out on Monday announcing the policy.
As parents, my husband and I are always thinking about our kids growing up and making their own decisions. And in a few years, they'll be heading off to parties, to music festivals. And like all parents, I often catch myself thinking, what if the worst happens? What if one of them doesn't make it home? And that's every parent's worst nightmare,
This move has been welcomed by the Alcohol and Drug Foundation, the Royal Australian College of GPs, the Pennington Institute, the Victorian Alcohol and Drug Association, as well as upper house crossbenchers from the Greens, Animal Justice and Legalised Cannabis parties, who introduced a joint bill to introduce a pill testing scheme last year. Congratulations, Greens.
Greens win.
We're on board. We're joining the great state of Queensland and the ACT for having pill testing at music festivals. Is this a victory for common sense, Emerald?
I mean, yes. Like, is it a result of Greens MPs and the AJP and stuff standing up at a press conference with speed dealer Sunnies? I'm sure.
I think it played a role.
It is quite remarkable, the turnaround on this. And I know you kind of pulled together a few examples of this where Jacinta Allen and the Labor Party in general had been like, no, pill testing bad. We're not going to do it. We don't want to green light drugs. The Greens want drugs for everyone. They want your kids to be on drugs. And then she's like, oh, actually, as a mother, though, it seems like, is she literally saying, she said she changed her mind now that she, as a mother, is thinking about her kids getting to that age. So you're telling me that now that your kids are old enough to potentially be at risk of overdosing at a festival, now it's worthwhile protecting them or putting in place like further protections for them. But when it was everyone else telling you, when other people's kids were dying of overdose who didn't have the opportunity to access information about what they were taking, that was fine. Like, that's an insane, I don't know. I think that line of argument that she has taken, that she's like, well, now I'm thinking about my kids. I find that quite offensive, actually.
If you'd asked me a couple of years ago, this wasn't something that I was particularly convinced on, she said. But particularly as my kids have become that little bit older and since becoming premier, this is something that I've wanted to deliver. I mean, you could listen to actual young people as well, rather than just and looking experts in your own immediate family. You could talk to people like Ave Pielli, who is the drug harm reduction spokesperson for the Victorian Greens, or the Animal Justice MP, like, or just all the experts that have constantly been telling you for ages. Listen to this. The announcement is a major shift from the government's previous position under Daniel Andrews, who rejected several coronial recommendations for a drug checking service. There have been five coronial recommendations that have been made for drug checking services in Victoria just since 2021, okay?
Cool.
So, look, I think the kids thing is bullshit, right? I mean, it's also come up this horror year we've had with, like, a lot of incidents at music festivals in which, you know, paramedics have had to respond to more cases in the first 3 months of this year than all of last year. There have been deaths. There have been massive overdoses, people being put into comas. Like, there's, you know, there is a growing problem which increases the political pressure. So I think she has to wheel out this as a mother nonsense. You're right, it is offensive and it should be criticised. But she's clearly just using that as some
She's got to have some, some reason kind of other than, oh, we realise we have majorly fucked up and potentially, like, failed to prevent potentially preventable deaths of young people. And so now we're finally jumping on way too late, but, you know, better late than never. No, she's got to have some some other
I haven't even looked
reason,
up how old
right?
her kids are. I'd be interested to see, like, what she looks like, whether they're there. Like 12 and 13. Like, well, they'll start going to music festivals in a few years, I suppose.
Yeah.
Pretty offensive. And of course, once again, great credit to Greens MPs for doing this. Genuine question here. I don't actually know this. When you get your pill tested at a music festival, what does that do for the legality of the pills at the rest of the festival? Obviously, there's an amnesty when you go to the pill testing site. No, you're not going to get into trouble for presenting drugs there. I get my drug tested. They let me know the information. I say, okay, I acknowledge the risk, but I'm going to take this drug with me. I won't hand it with you. I'll take it with me. Can you then get busted for drug possession in other parts of the festivals from sniffer dogs or cops?
It's basically an agreement with the cops. So it's purely up to whether they can, the government and all these organisations that are doing the pill testing, like the Loophole Pill Testing Australia, to come to an agreement with the police where they tell their officers to not charge people in those areas. And so, like, they fully could. They have the right, like, the legal right to. It's just about, like, operational guidelines. And there are operational guidelines around, like, in Queensland, for example, around access to all kind of drug services. So, like, needle exchange or safe injecting centres, places like that generally will have, like, operational guidelines that police shouldn't, what's the word, be a barrier to or inhibit access to those services. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And I know, for example, in Queensland, where they recently had drug checking at Rabbit's Eat Lettuce or one of these other festivals, and there were coincidentally enough, like heaps of roadside checks and police like on the way to the festival, and like the only road into the festival had all of these cops. So they can still do fucked up shit. Like that is the answer. But yes, it kind of just depends on how shitty the cops are in the area and what agreement they can come to.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, this is great news. This is a win for the Greens and Progressive Crossbench and all the experts that have been lobbying for this for years. And, you know, I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say that the delay in bringing this in has cost lives. And I think that the people in power should be conscious of that, and they should have that responsibility put on them. And we should also recognize this is in no way some great eureka moment from the Labor Party to recognize evidence-based harm reduction drug policies. This is the same Premier, Jacinta Allen, who has dumped government plans for a supervised injecting room in the Melbourne CBD, despite expert advice recommending a discreet service to be set up. That was a recommendation from the former police chief, Ken Lay. Looks into this.
The
again, so
of
many
cops.
Reports. All these people,
like
all these cops, retired
like,
cops say this is all bullshit. The drug war is bullshit. This is what we need to do. But because they're fucking cowards and don't want to wear the political cost, Labor governments will resist as long as they can or completely avoid the issue. So that is a disgrace. But again, thanks to Ave Puyelli, particularly, who's very public on this and has been fighting for this for a long time, the Progressive Crossbench, all the experts in the community. And I would just point out that I believe that both Assange and the pill testing argument, or basically, you know, harm reduction, evidence-based drug policy generally, great examples of the Greens being on the right side of history, being on the right side of the arguments, campaigning for years and years on it, getting demonized, getting dismissed, being told we don't know what the hell we're talking about. What do you know? That position becomes common sense and no credit is dished out. Now, I'm not saying that it's about credit. I actually don't care about that. It is important that the outcome happens, and that's good, and that's what politics is. But I just say that to remind the wonderful people listening to this podcast and progressive people generally that at the moments when you feel dispirited and you're so sick of being told you're such a fucking idiot, just remember these moments that you are right. You're not crazy. You are doing the right thing. You should listen to your heart and your brain and keep fighting for what you believe in.
And someday someone will say back to you the things that you've been saying for years and pretend that you never said them at all.
It makes you go crazy.
Yay!
Senator Fatima Payman joins Six News now for her very first interview since crossing the floor. Senator, good evening.
Good evening, Leo. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So,
speaking of crazy, things went haywire in the Senate this week when we had a Labor senator cross the floor for the first time in how many years? Well, in government since 1988. I think it was 2005 when someone in Labor last crossed the floor, but they were in opposition. Of course, talking about the WA Senator Fatima Payman crossed the floor to vote in support of a Greens motion calling on the Senate to recognise Palestine. Were you surprised? Were you, like others, not familiar with her game?
Look, I thought, we've talked about her a few times on the pod, right? Yes, and I have a growing level of respect for Fatima Payman. I assume that she's going through some pretty wild shit.
Yeah. Apparently she's being treated horribly, like just from what I'm...
By her Labor colleagues? But they believe in solidarity.
So crazy, isn't it?
I mean, it's so, again, it's like, because there was a story a little while ago about Labor potentially pre-selecting a Palestinian guy, like a Palestinian-Australian, and there was reports that he would be the first Palestinian-Australian elected, which I don't think is necessarily true because I think Joe Hockey, I don't know if Joe Hockey identified as Palestinian-Australian or just had Palestinian heritage. Anyway.
Oh, did he?
The point being that Labor were going to be like, hey, look, we're going to have a Palestinian in the federal parliament. And this just proving that it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't make a jot of difference. You were just going to be bowed by your own horrible decisions. And if you dare go against it and stand up for what you believe in something you might believe in as a Palestinian Australian, or even just as someone with a Muslim background connected to the Muslim community, you're going to be treated like shit and hounded out and demonized.
Well, this is the interesting question, I guess, is like, does this show though that Labor MPs can stand up for what they believe in and maybe what their electorate elected them to do without being kicked out, without facing severe consequences? Because all that's happened so far, I mean, she personally, I think, has faced like probably severe psychological warfare, but she's still in the party and I don't think she's going to get kicked out. That's my, like, let's jump straight to my take. I don't think she's going to get kicked out because surely it's just, that's electoral suicide. Like, it would be insane for Labor to do that. And they know that.
Well, yes. Yes, I think you're right. I think if she was going to get kicked out, it would have happened by now. My understanding is that there's a lot of disquiet within the party, the fact that she hasn't been kicked out.
Yeah.
And again, just to lay this out, she's broken the rules of caucus solidarity. That is, the parliamentary party is bound to follow the decisions decided by caucus, and you have to vote with the party. And again, you can cross the floor if you like, but you risk expulsion. That's been the general vibe.
Which she said she was, you know, clear on. Like, she knew in crossing the floor risks, that she risked to do it. Expulsion. Yes. To me,
but basically, they've just taken the bitchy move of icing her out, and she's not allowed to go to any more caucus sessions for the rest of the session, which sounds like a great win. It sounds like a win-win to me that you don't have to
go to fucking Labor meetings. Do you think, like, do you think she wishes they would just kick her out and get it over with so that she doesn't have to quit or continue, like, in this fucking abusive relationship with the Labor Party?
Not necessarily. I mean, that's certainly not what she said publicly, right? Like, she sort of said that this decision to stand up and vote on this motion was informed by what she describes as Labor values.
Labor values.
So she's turning this into a virtue. She's sort of saying this, you know, the same things that motivated me to join the Labor Party and run for Labor is the same thing that motivated me to cross the floor and support this motion and stand up for Palestine. I mean, look, I don't know much about Fatima Payne's personal life or connections community or whatever, but I assume that she's being pulled in a number of different directions.
Yeah.
And thank God she's listening to her heart and her conscience and doing the right thing, and, you know, credit to her for doing that. And against that is the evil machinations of the Labor Party that is trying to drum the good out of you for the sake of the party discipline and power, because, of course, that's more important than standing up for what's right.
Yes. Yeah, I just think, I don't know, I get the sense whenever she's asked about this that she's sort of like, well, I'm just waiting to see what they do. Like, I believe I did the right thing. And she's acting in accordance with what I think she, believes the Labor Party is meant to stand for and what she's meant to stand for as a Labor senator. I think there's kind of
it's Labor policy to recognize a Palestinian state. Yeah, well,
it's Labor policy. That's exactly right. But I guess it's like, but if you think that I'm doing something so wrong, and surely, like, if you think it's so bad that you are not allowing me to come to meetings, et cetera, and you're going to treat me like shit, then just kick me out. That's how I would feel anyway. But, yeah, I mean, it's pure speculation on what she is feeling and what she would want.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, I would say that she's not going to break before Labor would. That is, she wouldn't renounce this position for the sake of maintaining her membership of the Labor Party. I think that's true. I think she would accept expulsion for the party on this principle if it came to that. We don't think that's, yes, as you said, I don't think it's going to happen because the optics are terrible. Penny Wong's defending this decision, saying the Prime Minister is showing restraint while also still defending the principle of caucus solidarity, which maybe we'll get to because Penny Wong thinks it's the principle that served us really well.
Oh, no, let's talk about it. Yeah, so because initially, you know, they obviously, Labor's asked what's going to happen, what are the penalties that are going to be applied to Payman, and Rich Miles, Deputy PM, was saying there's not going to be any expulsion or anything of that kind, straight up. On Wednesday morning he was saying that. It was only during question time that we learned from Albanese, in response to a question from Dunn about why she hadn't faced any consequences, he was saying, I met with her and basically I told her not to come to caucus meetings until the end of the session. That concludes on the 4th of July. And then towards the end of the week we get Penny Wong weighing in with an incredible take, basically being the headline, in fact, in the Sydney Morning Herald was, Wong on Payman, she should vote with us, like I had to on gay marriage. Quote, Penny Wong has slapped down first-term Labor Senator Fatima Payman for crossing the floor, with the foreign minister pointing out she had had to vote against same-sex marriage before Labor changed its position. In a thinly veiled warning to Payman, who this week voted with the Greens on a motion to recognise Palestinian statehood, Wong said she understood why her Labor colleagues were upset and that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese had shown great restraint by only suspending Payman from one caucus meeting.
Yes, the real hero in this situation, Anthony Albanese.
Is Anthony Albanese. That's so strong and restrained of him. Like, that's so good of him. And I just, like, it's wild that this is, she really decided to go with it. She really decided to remind us all that she voted against what she believed in, against something that, like, the vast majority of their base clearly believed in, and something that we all now agree is good, same-sex marriage, for years and years. And then she's like, and that's good? And that's what you should do? Are you insane?
Yeah, look, I mean, I watched this interview that it comes from. It's her talking now, sitting down with Kieran Gilbert from Sky News. He mentions the same-sex marriage thing in passing, in which he said, you voted for this when you didn't agree with it. And Petty Wong's sort of like, yes, I did, and then kind of moves on. And she talks in general terms about the principle. Then they kind of ran with that headline, which gives the impression that she literally had a quote saying.
Okay, so she didn't come out with it. Well, her fault for, you know, joining a shitty party that she and then voting in line with their shitty position for years.
It still sucks. It's not like Penny Wong's out there on the front foot saying that. Now, I certainly believe that Penny Wong believes that she did the right thing in that situation.
Yeah.
And she still has this politician brain and this ridiculous notion that party discipline and party solidarity is more important, and that Labor, her remaining in the party to eventually change the Labor Party's position on same-sex marriage is a vindication of her approach, failing to see what any ordinary person would see, which is that's an example of everything that people hate about politics and people being dishonest and lying to your fucking face, and a party system that results in a queer woman looking you in the eye and arguing against her own civil rights and celebrating that as if it's a political achievement, and that makes sense, as opposed to most people seeing that and going, that sucks, I hate you all.
Yeah. And then taking, so that she can take more than a day. Like, even if you accept the argument that it was all worth it because she stayed in there and she fought for change from within and got the Labor Party to change its mind, it took more than a decade. Like, surely any other use of her time would have been a better way to achieve that end. But no, that's the acceptable political route.
To the point in which they fucked their opportunity to do that when they were in government, and same-sex marriage came under a Liberal government, more than a decade later.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. Fucking plebiscite.
The same-sex marriage debate is an example of how cooked your party is anyway, because most Labor members supported marriage equality. The only reason the party didn't go with it is because of a bunch of socially conservative, anti-communist fuckheads at the top of the SDA who had an excessive amount of power over the Labor Party platform. That's the tremendous system that you're defending here, if anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think, what do you think are the impacts of this electorally? Because like I said, I kind of wonder if it will help Labor, particularly in Labor versus Greens races, where Labor can, there is evidence now that you can elect a Labor MP to stand up for and vote in accordance with like your shared values, and that they will do that. And Fatima has actually done the Labor Party a great service in proving that can happen. She is the one example of that. The flip side of that, of course, is she has shown that it's possible, and so it raises the question, and this is the question that's being asked by the Greens quite consistently now, which is why can't every other MP here do that then? All these Labor MPs who say that they care about XYZ, including Palestine, why can't they stand up for what they believe in like Fatima can?
Because party discipline is more important. The caucus solidarity, the principle of caucus solidarity, and the power of the collective, as Penny Wong framed it, that is the collective of parliamentary MPs, as opposed to, I don't know, your membership or people generally, is more important in their mind than, standing up for what is right and the correct position on recognizing the state of Palestine, which more than 130 other countries do. That is Labor Party policy. What's more important than all of that is maintaining caucus solidarity in the parliament, i.e. my parliamentary career.
Well, I mean, in her exclusive first public interview since she crossed the floor, which was with Six News, the teenage journalists.
Yes,
incredible. Leah Puglisi, insane that he got this story. This is like the biggest political story in a long time.
James Masola from the Sydney Morning Herald. Tweeting sultily, she's been refusing interviews, and here she talks to this little child.
Yeah, because he's a better journalist than you. Yes. Anyway, and she was saying in that interview, like, yes, people in the community are coming up to me or emailing me. I'm getting all this contact, basically saying, I wish my local MP would do what you're doing. I wish my local MP would follow you. Yes. And so, yes, I think that it's absolutely the message here. It will be interesting to see. There is speculation about when Parliament next sits, will the Greens test it again, basically, see if she'll do this again, force Labor to again make the decision whether they're going to allow her to continue breaking party rules, crossing the floor on this, or whether they expel her. I think the caucus can decide to expel her from party room, from sitting with Labor in Parliament. in terms of whether she is a member of the Labor Party, that's up to their national executive. What do you think if this happens again? If the Greens put up another motion like this, what happens?
Mate, if she crosses again, I don't know. Maybe it seems like they will need something else to trigger action of expelling her from the party. I mean, I think good. This should cost the Labor Party's position on Israel-Palestine, their complicity in the genocide, their failure to stand up for what's right, should cost them. It should cost them votes. It should cost them parliamentary headaches. It should cost them members. And I cannot think of a more important principle upon which to stand up. You know, your opposition to genocide, your belief in human rights, your recognition of what is happening to the Palestinian people in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli state, one of our allies. If this isn't important to stand for, you know, what is? Yeah. So, you know, stay strong, Fatima Payman, please.
Yeah. I think speculation that she might leave, like quit Labor and join the Greens, I think that's kind of unlikely. Like, I think she would probably end up as an independent. Worth noting that David Pocock as well, shout out, he also voted in support of the Greens' motion on recognizing Palestine. But hey, remains to be seen. Maybe we'll be back here next week with another little update. Nobody likes
a bargain. G'day, Bladey kids, and welcome back to another episode of How Fucked is Australia's Vape Industry? And today, it's the most fucked it could possibly get. It doesn't get any more fucked. You might say it's proper fucked. Please call your members. Don't bother fucking calling the ones that aren't in power, because those fucking Greens cunts have done absolutely nothing for vaping. They just folded like a wet fucking towel and let Butler do exactly what he wanted. They put up no resistance, didn't get anything changed, didn't get anything watered down. They're pathetic. So fuck you, Greens. Thanks for nothing.
Meanwhile, Greens win? ? On vaping? The Greens also used their balance of power in the Senate again this week to secure amendments to the government's vaping regulation bill. They agreed to support it after removing the requirement for people to have a prescription in order to access vape, so they'll be able to get one from a chemist without a prescription. I saw this and I was like, wow, that's a pretty significant, I mean, win, or at least a significant thing for the Greens to secure using our powers. But then the more that the week kind of unfolded, the more I was like, have we done the thing again where we've managed to piss everyone off and please no one?
Everyone seems very angry. The smoking, the vaping Bogan is furious with us.
The vaping Bogan on YouTube is really angry, and he has a lot of subscribers.
Yes, he's massive. I just don't get vaping culture. Okay, I'm a social smoker. I don't really smoke that much anymore. I've smoked cigarettes in my time.
You don't vape?
Never got into vaping. Not into it in any way. Cannot understand people's investment connection to it. I'm not judging or anything. I'm just saying I don't get it. It's just not me. And I don't know how you build hundreds of thousands of subscribers talking amazing, exclusive hey? About Bogan and vaping-based issues, but what the hell do I know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, my knowledge of vaping, obviously I don't have any personal knowledge. We did do, for anyone who wants to go back and listen, and I'd be curious to listen back myself and see how this holds up or what is relevant, but and. Episode about a year ago, Patreon episode number 22 with Colin Mendelson from the Australian Tobacco Harm Reduction Association, I believe. We did a whole episode about vaping and vaping policy. That is quite interesting. I did want to just say, though, Colin kind of fucking tricked us because Colin, we asked and he was adamant and still is adamant. He's never taken any money from the e-cigarette industry, the vaping industry. And I think that is true, but I learned only this week that the Australian Tobacco Harm Reduction Association, of which he is like a founding member or whatever, did receive seed funding from e-cigarettes. So I think that's a little bit fucking sneaky, Colin, and I'm not happy about it.
Okay,
so,
from e-cigarettes, right. And isn't it true that there are like big tobacco has also moved into the vaping space as well? There's a bit of that nonsense going on too. Okay.
Yeah. But I will say, I still think that a lot of the arguments that he made, I agree still with a lot of what they say, which is that fundamentally, you know, a harm reduction approach that prohibition doesn't work, criminalization doesn't work. If you make it more difficult to access vaping, more people will A, stick with smoking, or B, turn to the black market. And that, yes, even if vaping is dangerous and we don't necessarily know the full effects of it yet and the long-term effects, it is like smoking cigarettes is so fucking harmful that it is a good thing to get people to replace smoking with vaping.
Yes.
That's the fundamental thing. You don't have to think that vaping is good. You don't have to think that it's safe.
Yeah.
But cigarettes are like the worst fucking thing that you can do to your body. Like, we know how fucking insanely bad for us they are. And then we know that Australia has not been doing a great job recently of reducing smoking rates, whereas other countries like New Zealand, for example, where it's been easier to access vapes, they have their smoking rates have been going down. So, like,
yes.
I it's interesting.
The moment in this video, this the smoking Bergen video we're mentioning is like smoking a clip Bergen in which he reacts very angrily in a charming way to this news about this regulation, which we'll get to in a moment. But the moment that sort of hits you, he's like,
they're looking at over $1 million fine and 7 years in fucking jail for selling vaporizers, for selling people a less harmful alternative to fucking smokes, which are still readily available without a prescription, not through a pharmacy, at every fucking bloody Coles and Woolworths and service station, corner store. It's a fucking joke. They haven't touched cigarettes, but they are going to absolutely destroy the vape industry, the legitimate businesses that want to help you stay off the fucking durries.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty strong argument to sort of say that something's a little bit messed up here. But just for my own sake, and for the listeners, like, what was the actual regulatory debate here, and what's going on?
Yeah. So it's a little bit the history of like vaping regulation. I mean, it's a classic thing where a new technology appears and then the government's kind of scrambling to try and figure out how to regulate it. Mm. And so things have changed a bunch over the last decade or so. It was initially, as I understand it, the coalition government that banned the retail sale of nicotine vapes and introduced like this prescription model. That was, again, I think strengthened in 2020 or 2021. And the interesting thing is that at that time, the Greens supported a ban on nicotine vapes without a prescription. The problem is there is not a single TGA approved nicotine vape available in Australia. And so they then ended up having to reclassify nicotine in 2021 so that doctors could prescribe non-approved nicotine vapes. Mm. But the idea is, you're meant to not be able to buy nicotine vapes at retail stores, but they all just sold them there anyway. So they would sell quote unquote non-nicotine vapes and all these flavored vapes, but they actually did have nicotine in them. Fewer than 10% of vapers have got a prescription. And even this year, you know, so then that's the problem that's been presented, right? There's been a growing black market. People aren't getting prescriptions. That clearly doesn't work. The government goes, we need to do something different. We need to crack down on vaping because people are getting more and more worried. All these kids are vaping. That's a genuine problem. Mm. This year, from the start of this year, they banned all imports of disposable and then non-therapeutic vapes were banned. You were meant to have an import permit to be able to import therapeutic vapes. You probably will have noticed since then or even in the last few months, like since the stock that people have been able to import has gone down, everyone's been struggling to get vapes. Obviously, it's harder and harder to get disposable vapes anymore, which is what people have got used to using because no one gets a fucking prescription. I realized what a massive thing this was because I don't really pay that much attention, but my boyfriend vapes. He has a prescription for a nicotine vape that he now uses instead of smoking cigarettes, and brought like a nicotine vape to a weekend away for a friend's birthday on an island. And the way that people who had never met him before would like see him arrive to the venue wherever we were and just like gravitate towards him and just be like, hey man, how you going? And I'm like, fuck, you all need that fucking nicotine so bad because it's so hard, it's difficult to get one.
Yeah, it's almost addictive, isn't it? It's very
Moorish. Yeah, really Moorish. People just want a little bit more. Anyway, okay, so now we end up, the next stage was meant to be the government wanted to ban the sale of all vapes without a prescription. This bill also included a bunch of stuff around plain packaging and limiting the flavors and nicotine concentrations. So really clear information on exactly what is in the vape that you're buying and how much nicotine is in there. The Greens have come in and secured a bunch of amendments in order for them to support it in the Senate, including a clarification that there'll be no criminal penalties for possession of personal use quantities of any form of vape. So the government wasn't necessarily like saying that there were going to be criminal charges for this, but I think they they got them to add a clause clarifying that there would be no, that there was no intention to do that, or that they should never be subject to criminal charges. They got this amnesty period and this disposal framework expanded so that people can get rid of their vapes if they've got them. They got a review of the legislation after 3 years, since it's all new and we don't know if it's going to work. Extra money just to support young people quitting vaping. And most significantly, from October, vapes will be available from a chemist as a Schedule 3 pharmacist-only medication for adults over 18 years without a prescription.
So, okay,
yeah, that is that. This is the big difference: is no prescription. You can go to a chemist from October. So there's a bit of a funnily, like, it's kind of weird because it'll go no vape without a prescription for a few months while we sort this out, and then October you will be able to get a vape without a prescription, but only from a chemist. Do you reckon this is a good compromise?
So this is the big headline: that all the retail vape shops, they are going to go out of business, or they can't sell vapes as they previously have been. If you want to get a vape, you don't need a prescription, but you will have to get it from a pharmacy or a chemist.
That's right. You have to be an over 18. If you're under 18, you can get a prescription from a GP to get. And it's the idea is you're only meant to be able to access vapes as a smoking cessation device, which is why then they're only available in three flavors: tobacco, menthol, and mint. They're all plain packaging. You know, it's not for fun kids. No more vanilla ice. Vapes.
Once again, the vaping bogan seemed particularly furious about the delicious flavors.
That people really do like. Yeah. They really do say this, that like that actually does seem to be a big sticking point for vapists. They're like, what? Like, no fucking. I don't want to buy.
They can't be called vapists. They cannot be called vapists.
I quite like calling them that. Actually, it's quite funny. the vapists. They want cherry flavor. They want pineapple. Anyway, that's why, they're pissed off because they're like, well, okay, I don't want to fucking go to a chemist, first of all. Like, I have to go to a chemist to get a vape. I want it to be yummy flavored and stop being so annoying and fucking everything over. So the vapists are annoyed. The chemists don't want to do it. They don't want to be vape dealers. There aren't many approved products. It's, like I said, there's no TGA approved products. So I don't even, this, I really struggled to get my head around how this works, but I think it's like you can then, they can supply some products if they're not TGA approved, if they decide that it would be an effective smoking cessation device. But that's one of the problems, is there's not many approved products and they have to get approved showing the quantity of nicotine and the concentration of nicotine and stuff. All of this then means that, well, the criticism is it'll still be too difficult to access a vape that people want. If they want a vape, they'll go to the black market. Or if they were thinking about vaping instead of smoking, they'll just go, well, why the fuck would I? It's going to taste like tobacco and be harder to get than cigarettes anyway. So I'll just keep smoking cigs.
And sorry, just go back. Why is the Pharmacist Guild so opposed to this? I mean, it would be good for business, right?
Isn't I know,
it good
it's for a business? Bit insane.
The statements that I got from that vaping bogan video is that they don't endorse the idea that it is an effective smoking cessation device. But it really did seem like we don't want dirty vapors in our chemists and pharmacists, which seems
that's what I reckon.
A really gross vibe. Yeah.
Yes, they're not happy. So the Pharmacist Guild put out this media release that was simply titled "Not Tobacconists or Garbologists,"
Jesus.
Because they're going to have to deal with the disposal of the vapes as well. But they don't want to be vape dealers. They don't want to. They would be required to, because of the schedule it's on. They have to have, you know, a conversation. They have to determine that this would be an effective smoking cessation device for people. They don't want to have to do that. It's probably going to take up their precious time. I think it's pretty fair to be like, well, this happened very quickly and there was probably very little, if any, consultation of them, and now they've got to retrain everyone and figure out a new process for this. The other argument, though, like, I've seen arguments reported in the ABC that was like, they're going to be the targets of crime because they're going to be storing vapes and people are going to break into the chemist to get the vapes. And I was like, are you aware what chemists sell? Like, I'm not quite buying that it's going to be the vapes that are going to cause people to break in to a chemist. But I do think it is partly, like, I think there's a stigma around vapes, and they're like, we don't want to be fucking selling these things to the people who want to use them. And yes, in their media release, they continually do use the line that there is no evidence or no clear evidence that vaping is an effective smoking cessation device. There is evidence that it's dangerous. This is where I'm like, I'm not a fucking expert. I'm not a doctor. But to me, I believe Colin Mendelsohn, even though your little company got the money that you didn't tell me about, I do believe that, like, there is evidence that it can help. Like, and I've seen people, you know, replacing smoking with vaping. And I don't really understand, I guess, because there's no TGA approved products, then they're just, they're like, well, technically it's not approved in that way. And so the evidence isn't there. But
yeah, well, once again, to cite my only source on this, the vaping Bergen, he was citing reports from the NHS.
We've got our one vaping source. Yeah,
that
one.
That's the research I did for the story, is watching that 11-minute video. But he was citing the NHS, right? It's that apparently the NHS is much more advanced on this and sort of recognizes the benefits that some people have when it comes to getting off smoking via vaping. I guess, you know, the Pharmacists Guild of Australia is obviously going to cite our local drug regulation bodies. And if they haven't come to that position, they're going to cite that as evidence. But there you go. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. The retailers are obviously pissed off because they can't run their business anymore. But I think what's kind of confusing is, like, the retailers in the news are like, well, we're the ones that have been following the law. We don't sell the nicotine vapes. We only sell non-nicotine vapes anyway. But it's like, do you want to just continue to be able to sell? Did you want to be able to sell the nicotine vapes? This is the question, right? So later in the week, after all this prevaricating, and as I said, after previously the Coalition being the ones to introduce the prescription-only model, the Libs just randomly, some would say unnecessarily, come out with their position that they would reverse the vapes ban and instead install their own system to tax and regulate vapes similarly to tobacco. So retailers would be able to sell them, not just chemists. It's actually a more liberal approach than the Greens. I feel like I'm in a real topsy-turvy world with this, because the Coalition, their lines are fully like, prohibition doesn't work. We need to reduce harm. We need to tax and regulate these substances. Like, it is really fucking weird. I mean, do you think that model would be preferable? Because that seems like that is the model that a lot of the pro-vapists, at least, are advocating for.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess the Greens' amendments, I think we would agree, make a good, like, have improved this bill
better than needing a prescription.
Better than what would have happened.
Yes.
Now, of course,
removes a significant barrier.
Yeah, if you're pro-vaping, invest in vaping, you're not particularly, you know, people don't appreciate the benefit of how worse the law would have been without your intervention. Yeah. They just look at the impact of the law, which is probably fair enough. So the bigger question as to whether or not this approach should happen at all. I mean, I think we've talked about it before. Yes, it does seem like we have a inconsistent approach, a harm minimization approach to some drugs, mainly recreational drugs, we view on that, and a different approach to, nicotine, tobacco and vaping, which does seem a little inconsistent. Yeah. The black market argument I think is still pretty strong. I think it's very hard to see people completely getting off this stuff. I think you could imagine people just continuing their nicotine addiction through either smoking or using other products and stuff to pursue that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, the general position on these drugs, we think, is what? Regulation, legalization, harm minimization and education. And I don't know why that we wouldn't apply that to vaping too.
I think what's interesting is that the Greens still haven't really, like, in New South Wales, perhaps they propose that retailer model, but I'm not sure that the Greens have been like, well, our ideal would be that they are available, like, under this model. They've really just spoken about the amendments that they've secured. So naturally they're presenting them as positive amendments that are better than the government's model. There are there are questions though about the retail model, and particularly the kind of line that it's like, well, we tax them heavily and we use that money to then support education campaigns or healthcare campaign healthcare programs, etc. Because there's a question about whether the retail model for cigarettes is working that well. We obviously have seen a pretty significant fall in smoking over the last 20, 50 years, but not that rapid. And I think there's a question about whether over the last few years the fall in taxation revenue from cigarettes, from tobacco, is attributable to fewer people smoking or more people buying black market cigarettes. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I know a lot of people just buy illegally imported cigarettes from under the counter at tobacconists, because cigarettes from licensed retailers are way too expensive.
Mm. I guess you could argue this isn't technically, even calling it a vaping ban is somewhat misleading, right? I mean, this is just an example of heavily regulating a particular drug, right? Or drug or.
Yeah. Well, you're still, you're criminalizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're criminalizing retailers if they sell this.
Yes.
But yes, does that mean the drug is criminalized or it is just that's how it's heavily regulated?
I mean, I do have some sympathy. I mean, we've talked about the approach in New Zealand of them sort of phasing out the idea of smoking, like raising the age at which you can buy cigarettes to try and phase out the idea of a generation taking up cigarettes in the first place. And I suppose I do think there are some legitimate concerns about kids, and I think we know this, there are lots of Zoomers and kids who go directly to vapes, right? They skip the whole cigarette deal and just fully get on the vape. Now, yes, are they going to access that by whatever means necessary to do that?
Or access something like that, you know, like if it's not vapes, is it going to be something like the kids who are looking for something?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think like from my observations and even just anecdotally, I think I would stick with a harm reduction approach and probably making lower harm alternatives available, more available is a positive thing, making them affordable and accessible. But that only works if you also have other supports. You know what I mean? Like I think if you're dealing with addiction in particular, just the regulation around access is never going to be enough without community support networks and mental health support and, you know, even things like housing and social security are all going to play into how that person uses that substance, what substance they use, how sustainable it is, how damaging it is. So
it's interesting too because the other story with Gen Z more broadly is that they are drinking less and using less drugs, right? Now, that none of that is because of their lack of access to those things. We know that's right. Like they have plenty of access to both of those things.
If you've got a phone, you can access drugs,
Yes, but it is about, I mean, I think a level of education and awareness, I think that does have an effect and a perception of it. I mean, yes, I think, again, we know prohibition doesn't work. A realistic approach to the fact that some people are going to take drugs, and what do we do about that as a society rather than demonizing them, criminalizing them, or pretending as if we can stop that supply? It's always a great approach. So, again, I have some sympathy for the Greens' approach to this. Whether they would, I mean, what would be the alternative is to simply say we're not going to support this legislation at all.
And I don't think that the government, I find it really hard to imagine the government going any further than this because they have been trying to take such a hard line and are still copping flack even like, there are so many organizations slamming them for even removing the prescription requirement. I just don't think they would have gone any further. So I can understand the Greens striking this balance. Yes, it's unfortunate that it probably won't make anyone too happy, but I think it is an improvement on what was proposed.
G'day, g'day, how you going? What do you know? I'll strike a light. G'day, g'day, and how you going? Just say g'day, 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 and you'll be right.
Alrighty, well, you know, it was a big one. We got there in the end. We're only a little bit over an hour. Next week, the news should try to be less quiet for us, please, because there's just too more much quiet going on. We didn't even get to talk about the fact that Green supporters don't support marching in the streets anymore, according to polling. So we'll let the audience just mull over that one themselves.
Write a letter. That's the only thing you're allowed to do.
Write a letter. Yeah, that's right. We should cut this section because we know you guys don't support any kind of actual action. No, look, call to action. If you do want to support harm reduction initiatives like pill testing, drug checking, all those sorts of things, Harm Reduction Australia is a good kind of peak body, harmreductionaustralia.org.au, and they also help coordinate a fundraiser specifically for Pill Testing Australia, who help run those drug checking services at festivals and I think also at some of the fixed sites. They collaborate with services to do that in Queensland, certainly. So we'll put the link in the show note for that. Also wanted to give a quick shout out. New South Wales Young Greens are doing an organising and campaigning fellowship for under 31-year-olds. It's, as I understand it, like consists of like a bunch of training sessions and there's kind of residential weekends or residential 2-day blocks where you learn a bunch of skills. The program is free. People who are not cisgendered and who are a person of color are being prioritized. There's a whole bunch more info. We'll put the link in the show notes. Applications are closing, I guess, this week, 5th of July. So have a look. We did an organizing fellowship as well in Queensland. I think they've done it in Victoria as well. And I think it's a really good opportunity, and we need more good young people in there fighting the good fight and organizing and campaigning as the movement grows. Otherwise, we literally can't grow without it. So have a look.
Check the show notes for all the links for those details, etc., and some more reading on this week's topics if you like. Thank you very much for listening. We covered all the news this week. We'll catch you again next week.
Bye. Bye.
Serious danger to Australia.